This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Alfred DeMilo on the 24th of January, 2003 at approximately 1:45 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. DeMilo is in Ambridge, Pennsylvania. Sir, why don't we begin the interview with a brief discussion of your early life, and if you would please tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born on July 13, 1946 in Swickley, Pennsylvania. That was the closest hospital. And grew up in the first part of my life was in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, which is my address now, but I actually live in a little place called Harmony Township. And my parents moved to Baden, which is the next town down, just a few miles away. And that's where I spent my formidable years until I joined the service. Baden was too small to have a high school, and they were in the Ambridge School District, so I graduated from high school from at the Ambridge Area School District. And growing up from there, I was accepted at several colleges, had enough of schooling, though, enough of going to school. Didn't feel like going to college, but my father said as long as I lived under his roof, I had to take some type of classes, so I entered into a Penn State branch extension here at Quaker Valley and worked in a steel mill. It carried about 6 credits, but that wasn't enough to keep me out of the draft, mm-hmm. if you want to go that far at this time.
Oh, well, if you want, we can take a moment and look at a couple of other things about your youth.
Okay.
Any particular subjects you enjoyed in school?
History.
Okay.
Science were my two favorites.
How about sports? Athletics?
Yes, I didn't participate. Well, I was on the track team in high school, but really wasn't big enough for the football team or quite good enough for baseball, but was the time I grew up on the street or in the fields, or, you know, around the around my neighborhood, somebody was always playing sports. It wasn't like it is today. You know, whatever sport was appropriate is what we were doing after school, and I did enjoy it.
Okay.
I wasn't very active in high school as far as other clubs or anything. I mean, I had friends. Really wasn't a loner, but I didn't participate much at all in high school activities other than track.
How about work? What kind of work did you do growing up?
And my father had a neighborhood store. He was a mechanical engineer, but we also had a store right next to our house. And I guess he had that for about 5 years, and it was all your spare time, just about. You know, you could sneak out once in a while, but you were going to get stuck in that store working quite a bit, and I hated it.
Did you really?
Yeah, I couldn't stand it.
What did you dislike about it?
It was like, you know, everybody else is headed with their baseball bat or their football to go play after school, and you had to go into the store.
Yeah.
But, you know, some days I was, you know, I got to go, and my brother had to work. And instead of having the whole weekend off, you were going to work in there one day during the weekend, you know, Friday night or Saturday. And we were open 7 days a week. So that's what I didn't like about it. And I've never really been a people person, and I don't like really that much contact with people.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you get paid when you worked in your dad's store?
No, but he never, there was no regular salary, mm-hmm. but if you were going out, had a date or whatever, he made sure that you had cash in your pocket.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't tight that way.
Mm-hmm.
He was tight other ways, but he, you know, he understood that you worked and that there should, you know, you should get something for it.
Right. Well, you said that was only for 5 years. That
right.
The store. What other kind of work did he do?
Well, you know, it was a neighborhood store, so it was all in this area, this part of the country. Fresh lunch meat was very big because of the steel industry, and men worked 3 shifts, and they took lunches, so you cut lunch meat. It had, you know, canned goods on the shelf, fresh bread. It was, you know, a small, like, superette type of thing. It wasn't like your 7-Eleven or anything like that. Everything in it was, fruits were fresh and things like that. And a penny candy aisle for kids and your ice cream bars and things, so if you were in there by yourself, you'd get quite busy at certain times of the day. Mm-hmm. And it was even robbed one time.
Wow.
I wasn't in it at the time. Mm-hmm. They did do a pretty good job on my grandmother who worked there, who was pretty young, a pretty young lady when she came to live with us when her husband passed away. So, it was basic clerking in the store.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other kind of employment for you as you got older, as a teenager?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I went into the steel mill.
Okay.
And even when I was working in the store, I took side jobs in the summer cutting grass, in the winter shoveling sidewalks, you know, anything to pick up a few extra bucks. When I graduated from high school, I went right into the steel mill. Within a few months, the jobs were plentiful at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And went to college on the side.
What kind of work did you do in the steel mill?
I was in the inspection department, and pretty much once in a while I'd get a better job, but most of the time I had a large handheld grinder that took seams out of pipes. When pipe came out and it was rolled, sometimes it would leave a mark on it, and that had to come down. Most of the pipe we made were for oil wells. For oil well use. It was a big plant, which is now completely closed up and empty. It was very dirty and hard and heavy work.
Mm-hmm. And, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and I'm glad that I didn't make a, stay there the rest of my life.
Yes, sir. Well, had anybody in your family served in the military during World War II?
Yes. I believe all of my father's brothers, he had four brothers, and they all served, and I think two of my mother's brothers were old enough to go, and they had a big influence on me about the service. My father didn't go, he had one of those defense jobs where he was exempt, even though he went as far as Cleveland to try to join up, and I guess they just wouldn't take him if he didn't have a release.
Hmm. What kind of work did he do?
Me?
Did he do when he was during the war?
He's always been in engineering.
Oh, okay.
And they switched over his plant to whatever it was. At the time, he was in a place called National Electric. And whatever they did, they switched it over to, you know, war, to gear up for the war. So they were making things, what I don't recall him telling me, but they were making things for the war. And so he was considered essential in that job and was not released.
Okay. But he kept on traveling, trying to get in.
Yes, he did, because I wasn't born yet, and I don't think my older brother was born until 1942.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was just exempt after that.
Yeah. Well, your uncles that did go, what branch of the service and what theater did they serve?
My mother's two brothers. One was in the day he got out of high school, he went to the Navy, and he was on destroyer escort. It was in quite a few of the big battles in the Pacific. He has a lot of stories about Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And the kamikaze attacks. He since passed on. He was my godfather and a real likable guy. And her other brother went to the Merchant Marine Academy. He was an officer in the Merchant Marines and ran the North Atlantic route on merchant ships. And I believe it's sometime, this is where I'm a little foggy from the years, is I think it's sometime he switched over and got a commission with the Navy, but I know he did go to the Merchant Marine Academy. And then my dad's brothers, went to flight school and didn't make it through. Ended up in the Pacific in the Air Force doing what, I don't know, but I know he was wounded at, you know, a nighttime bombing attack, shrapnel. Another one drove on that a gasoline or some type of truck that fed, it followed Patton, or I guess Third Army through Europe. Another one was with war plans in England, plotting bombing raids. No, that was only three that went. I don't think his brother Dom went, so maybe three on my dad's side. And I know his older brother was too old to go. So five out of the immediate family.
Well, in what year did you graduate from high school?
1964.
When you graduated, of course, it was just months later. You probably graduated in the early summer.
Yeah, so June.
Just 2-3 months later, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin incidents, and the president decides to start sending troops into Vietnam. At that point, you were working in a steel mill.
Right.
Do you remember much about that, or were you pretty much focused and probably exhausted and not paying very much attention to world events?
I've always been a reader, and when it first took the Gulf and Tonkin incident, it first didn't grab much attention from me, but it wasn't long after it when I started noticing, you know, things escalating, that I started to read everything I could about Vietnam to try to stay up on the current events, and then seeing some of the guys that immediately went to one branch of the service or another after we got out of school. Some guys went, within a week or two. It seems like that when they were getting home from basic training, they were all told that, they're going to eventually end up in Vietnam. So it kind of got my attention. Whether all that was true or not, how the basic training, they always worst case your scenario.
Right.
But my best friend went to the Navy, and that's where he didn't end up in Vietnam, but off the coast in some support role within months.
Okay. Well, when did you receive your notice that you were drafted?
I went in at 66.
Okay.
But I received a draft notice in 65, but I can't give you the exact date.
Okay.
And but it was like, it gave me a maybe I didn't get my draft notice till 66, and I was already signed up. Maybe. I can't be clear on that. It was either my draft notice said I was supposed to leave the day that I originally was sworn in, or that's the day my draft notice came in the mail. I can't remember which one it was, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, sir. Well, what drew you to the military then?
I've always been attracted to the military. When I think back, World War II wasn't that far or wasn't that long ago when I looked at the men that were in World War II. In 1966, the war had only been over like 21 years. And now that I'm at this age, that's a drop in a bucket. That really wasn't that long. So it was fresh in their minds and that. And I talked to my uncles and I read war stories, books about the war, and like I said, I kept up on it with Time and Newsweek or whatever information I could get, the newspapers. I always bugged my uncles to tell me, what they did. But I do remember bits and pieces about Korea, even though I was young. And so I'd always been interested in the military. can't really say one thing about it, but there had always been some type of something going on militarily wise, you know, since I can remember. It was, if it, you know, very World War II, or it was still pretty fresh once I started remembering things, you know, guys talking about it. And Korea, and had some uncles that that were in the military during Korea, but were never sent over. So, always interested. Always interested in aviation.
Okay. Now, let's see. In terms of choosing the Army, what drew you to the Army as opposed to the branches?
The whole story is I was sitting in a doctor's office with a horrible sore throat, and I had already, I wanted some kind of adventure, and I was never really, for some reason, the Marines never, or Navy, never appealed to me, but I wanted to go to the paratroopers. So I went to a recruiter and I joined the paratroopers on a delayed entry program so I could stay home for Christmas and New Year's. And I was in a doctor's office with a terrible sore throat. And I picked up a Time magazine. It was right after the Battle of the Idrang Valley. It said, "The Army's crying for helicopter pilots. You don't need a college education." And that's what I thought you'd have to have to fly. Because all you got to do is... take it, you know, an IQ test, and then I can't remember the name of the other test you got to take, but it's about flight, you know, if you can adapt to flight training. And if you pass that, they'll give you a shot at the flight school, and if you flunk out, well, you don't do any more than the time than if you've been drafted. I think you owe them like 2 years from the day you flunk out or something. I said, boy, that doesn't sound bad. Basic training and flight school. So I went back to the recruiters right from the doctors. He said, "Gee, I wish if I'd have known you wanted flight school, you know, I'd have sent you for the test." He goes, "There's no problem." He says, "I'll send you for the test as soon as you feel better." So he sent me to Pittsburgh and went up and took the tests. And Pittsburgh's about 17 miles from here. And within a day or two, they had the results back, you know, complete physical and everything in it. Written test and said, "Hey, you know, we'll send you to flight school." And says you're going in the Army February 2nd, and that's what drew me to the Army was to fly helicopters.
Right. Now, how popular were or how did you what did you do for entertainment as far as movies, television, that kind of stuff? What programs did you watch very often or? Movies. What kind of movies did you like to see as you were growing up?
Well, growing up, westerns. Even though today I'm not that enthralled with them, and can't stand country and western music.
Okay.
But you know that at that time television was big. I liked Have Gun, Will Travel, but I did enjoy sitting down and watching Playhouse 90. I don't know if you're old enough to remember anything like that. They used to have some excellent entertainment. It was, you know, Playhouse 90 was live for 90 minutes on TV. You know, good stories. Some real classics. But, you know, variety shows. I love Jackie Gleason and Red Skelton show. I wasn't really set on one thing. When I was real young, there was a guy, Soupy Sales. It was hilarious. I think he was the original pie in the face guy, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there were a lot of westerns on at the time. You know, Gunsmoke. I don't know if you ever heard of the one I mentioned, that Have Gun, Will Travel.
Mm-hmm. I sure have.
So Richard Boone, in fact, he started out as a Shakespearean actor. There he was on the western. Did quite well. That's about it for TV, you know. But whatever was popular in the movies, I usually went to see. You know, that was good for dates. Drive-ins even better.
War movies?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I'm sorry I left that. Thanks for bringing that to attention. All the war movies, went to see them.
Any particular ones that were your favorites?
Boy, I'm drawing kind of a blank here right now. I can't remember if The Longest Day was out before I went to the service or after. Mm-hmm. Before I went to Vietnam or after.
Okay.
I got back. I can't remember the date of that. I thought that wasn't too bad for the time. But there were quite a few good movies, I thought. I think Gregory Peck was in, I think he was in Porkchopville. But I can't think of anything else right offhand.
Okay. I don't know if any of the John Wayne World War II movies or Sands of Iwo Jima, that kind of stuff.
I was never the biggest fan of John Wayne's. Sands of Iwo Jima was all right. You know, I certainly sat and watched it and had no complaints.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be my judgment's been tainted over the years, so I can't give an honest answer about what happened before, if you know what I'm getting at. John Wayne was okay.
Okay.
But there were a lot of other actors I liked better.
Who did you prefer? You mentioned Gregory Peck already.
Oh, yeah, I liked Gregory Peck, Jimmy Stewart. Oh, I'll tell you the war movie that, but I don't remember, it was 12 O'Clock High.
Okay.
Just a phenomenal movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But I get goosebumps thinking about it.
Okay.
You know, been in that situation. Another war movie that was absolutely excellent, but I can't remember if I saw it after. I don't remember when it was written.
Okay.
Well, I know when it was written. It was written during the Korean War, but I don't know if the movie was. Yes, I did. I think I saw it before I went to Vietnam. It was written by James Michener. Bridges of Tokoori.
Mm-hmm.
Might be the greatest flight movie ever.
Hmm.
Have you seen it?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And that was, what the heck was his name? Well, they were all good-looking guys, but Grace Kelly was in it. William Holden. You know, how you struggle with yourself, whether you're going to fly again. The same thing has happened to me. There's been days when I said I'm never going to get in that damn aircraft again. And you see everybody else in the morning getting in, so you crawl in too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the peer pressure kind of gets you.
Yes, sir. Well, in terms of your understanding of Vietnam and what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam. Before you left, what did you understand was going on?
Very naive. Thought it was good against bad. We were there to stop the red hordes, of communism. And, of course, we had no plan. I found out later, but that's what I thought. We were there to do something good. And, my second two tours, I found out that maybe it just wasn't that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did your family think when you went and told them that you were going to go ahead and enlist in the Army and become a pilot?
They were upset. But they knew they couldn't, because of my, I turned 19, and because of my age, they didn't have to sign anything.
Right.
And my mind was pretty well made up, and I'd been having some problems at home with them because I had a car. The old man wanted to know, where were you at till 4 in the morning,
Right.
Like, he's never been out till 4 in the morning when he was a kid.
Right.
And, that kind of thing, and I just got tired of living under his rules.
Mm-hmm.
I just said I'm going, and there's nothing they could do about it. And they were upset.
Mm-hmm.
but they understood that this is the way it was, and I guess maybe it was because of they knew that I was going to get drafted anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, the time was going to come. So that was about it.
What did you think of the draft? What did they think of the draft? Did they think it was appropriate at the time?
They didn't think it was fair. Neither did I. I thought it was definitely appropriate, but I didn't think there should have been. And this had nothing to do with the way I joined. I probably would have joined irregardless mm-hmm. of what I had done, but I don't think there should have been, well, this guy's out because of this, and that guy's out, got it because of that. And, you know, I know guys right here in my hometown that there was a doctor that that would make the appropriate entries on any physical for you to get you out if you wanted to go that particular route. And, you know, guys I used to be friends with that didn't go and weaseled out of it in some particular way, I certainly am not friends with them anymore. Mm-hmm. But I thought that, and I still feel that the draft should be back and everybody should serve some type of military duty to the country. And I'm not a real hawk either. I have a lot of questions about what's going on now, but I think everybody owes something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and you, when you went into the service in February, what was that transition like for you? Where did you go to basic training? What do you remember most of your first impressions?
Total cultural shock. Uh-huh. The day I left Pittsburgh, it was very cold, and I was going to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Cold, a lot of snow. It was so cold, I was just going to wear a light jacket. You know, of course, my mother, wear a heavy jacket. You could always send it home or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I got down there and it was so damn cold in Louisiana. I was, well, I'm glad I listened to her for the one time. And then we stood in this parking lot for about 2 days. They'd let you go to a restroom, but there was you never got a place to sleep other than they'd march you out of this parking lot. You'd take a test, they'd march you back to your spot. The only thing we had to eat for a couple of days were apples, and it was just that damp cold from like down south, and you could see the gate they brought us in on a bus where we got off of some airplane that brought us in, and I kept looking at that gate and I kept saying, if I could run home, boy, did I screw up? And I said, things could be any worse. It scared the hell out of me. It really did. And I was shocked beyond belief. Mm-hmm. But there was an older guy in the, who was going to flight school, who had been a hitch in the Marines and one in the Army Airborne, and he was 10 years older than me. And he and I got to be good friends, went through flight school and things. And he kind of calmed the young guys down. He did a real good job. Quite intelligent. And, Bob Edwards is his name. He's since passed away. And he said, it's not going to be any picnic, but believe me, things are going to get better. They're going to get us uniforms and a barracks, and you're going to get something hot. This will not last forever. So he was a steadying influence on us. Mm-hmm. But it was... Do you want to know more about basic training?
Yes, by all means. What was your routine like? Food?
Food.
All that stuff.
Food was
barracks?
Barely edible. Mm-hmm. But I found that when you're hungry, you'll eat anything. There were so many things that, I'd stare at my plate and say, boy, I didn't like that when my mother made it. It was just something, if I didn't care for spinach or something. Woof it down. I said, oh, I wish I'd do anything for my mother's spinach or fish, because I didn't like fish. The barracks were the old World War II wooden type that it had to be every year, every day, had the floor had to be buffed with this red dye that was it was in a granulated type form or powder, and it would get on everything. And it was so cold in the barracks. I was, you know, was there in the winter time, Fort Polk, and I can't remember how the barracks. I guess they were heated by coal. But I don't know, and we had to keep the windows open a certain, you know, 6 inches or something like that. That we would, there was a washer and dryer in the latrine, and it cost a dime to run the dryer, and would put money in the dryer and go out and stand outside and stand by the exhaust to warm up. That's how cold the barracks were. You know, waiting to fall in for formation or something like that when you couldn't get under your blankets. However, I thought that basic training did a pretty good job. I respected my drill sergeants, and I never thought that I was treated unfairly. We did have a couple of suicide attempts. I think one was serious, and I think the other one was half-hearted, you know, to get out. Had a couple. In my platoon, that wasn't in my platoon, that was in my company, but in my platoon we had a couple of men that were at McNamara's 100,000, I believe, where they he said that no matter how many times you got to recycle these guys, they'll eventually pick it up and they'll send them, you know, they can go, if you know what I'm talking about. You ever heard of that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so there was a few guys like that in our platoon. The poor fellows could barely write their name. And, you know, it was a shame what they went through. It was pure torture for them because they couldn't grasp what was going on. Yeah, I really felt for them.
What was the most challenging aspect of basic training for you?
I'm short.
Okay.
And the long walk to the rifle range or run. It was. It got to be where you either ran to the rifle range and walked back, or walked and ran back. And it was like an accordion.
Mm-hmm.
You could never seem to get everybody in the whole company going at the same speed. And being short, it was hard for me always to keep up. And that was probably the worst part of basic training, was the rifle range. Even though I scored expert with a rifle, I'm a very good shot.
Mm-hmm.
But just getting there and coming back, it just about killed me. And I was promoted, there weren't very many guys out of basic at the time that were promoted from E1 to, I don't know, it was E2, I guess, or something. But I think like five of us got, and I was one of the guys that got promoted up to either E2 or E3 or something out of basic. So evidently, I did all right.
Yeah.
With that, but most of the guys that were going to flight school did well.
What weapons were you firing then?
M14,
okay.
And I don't think that we, because we weren't going to AIT, they didn't bother teaching us anything else. I did think we might have fired the pistol. We might have fired a 45. But I know for sure we fired the M14.
Okay. When did you first get your hands on an M16? Is that in Vietnam?
Vietnam.
Okay. What was the ethnic makeup of your basic training group? Do you know, your platoon? Remember?
I'd say it was probably, boy, this is just a shot in the dark, probably a third black and two-thirds Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the Caucasian, there might have been a couple Hispanic. But that's pretty much what I remember. And most of the drill sergeants were black. And pretty sharp characters, or they you know, really had their stuff memorized well. You know, they couldn't trip them up on when they started their spill on whatever they were instructing you on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the ethnic background that I remember.
Were any of your drill instructors, did they have combat experience in Vietnam?
Yeah. Quite a few of them had, you know, like, I remember the ones that were with my platoon, basically, and I believe they, two I remember, and I believe they both had CIBs on. And that, now they could have got those in, you know, wasn't that far from Korea. And, you know, there were guys even, and I doubt that any World War II guys were still being a drill instructor because some of them were just E5s and E6s. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there was quite a few of the DIs that were walking around with the CIB, which I highly respect anybody that has earned a combat infantryman's badge. My hat's off. He's going to get the toughest job in the world as an infantryman.
What did you do after basic training? Did you go straight over to flight school?
I got to I went home for they sent me home on leave. Mm-hmm. And then I 2 weeks, and then I went to Fort Walters, Texas for flight school. There wasn't a flight class ready, and so I did what they called snowbird, which mm-hmm. that means you just hang around, you know, you're just a flunky. Mm-hmm. And did that for like about 2 weeks or so, or 3 weeks. And the other guys in my basic training unit, they did just the opposite, too. They kept them at Fort Polk for 2 or 3 weeks. Then they sent them home on leave and then sent them to Fort Walters. So we all met up again at Fort Walters, and we're all in the same flight class. Just got there at different times. Mm-hmm. And that I think we started in April, I think, something like that, of 66, maybe May. I remember it was really starting to get hot at the Miserable Gulch or Mineral Wells.
Okay. What? How long did that training last at Fort Walters?
I believe we graduated in October. And Fort Rucker was too crowded to take our class, and it wasn't just our class. This was an ongoing thing. So they held everybody over for an extra month. And the holdovers were just what they called super senior candidates. And we just were given odd jobs for a month, and then we were shipped. You know, another class would graduate from Fort Rucker, and then we were shipped to Fort Rucker. I believe we were there from, like, May till October for training, and then another month in November we went to Rucker.
Okay. And this is primary flight?
Yeah, primary flight was at Walters.
Okay. What was covered in that instruction, and you know, what were the interesting aspects of that training, the challenges?
Well, of course... you had your first month was pre-flight, where it was all classroom work and kind of a hell month where they had TAC officers that took care of the platoons, and they tried to get you to quit. You know, come in, mess your rooms up, you know, scratch the floor up after you polished it. A lot of physical training and classes, about 8 hours a day. I'm guessing about 8 hours a day. And then after that month, you went through, learned a solo. You were assigned an instructor who could have from 2 to 3 students with him. And his job was to get you soloed within, I believe the time limit was 15 hours. And if you didn't solo in 15 hours, hours might be off a little bit, but not more than 1 or 2. You were sent up for an evaluation ride. by another instructor to see if the instructor's missing something. You know, it might take just somebody else to say you're doing this wrong, you know, pick this up. But most of the guys soloed. We lost, but we did lose people in pre-flight, and we did lose guys that just could not solo. Some of them were given the opportunity to go back a class, and some of them were just shipped out, you know, to who knows where, but they were out of the flight program. And some of the guys quit. I found that there were some older guys in the class that were already fixed-wing qualified, and they were in their late 20s, and they were already they were getting fed up with the BS, and just said, "We don't need this. We'll just go and do 2 years in the Army." And they didn't like the helicopters. And I think we had one guy killed in that particular time, right after we soloed.
What happened?
The guy had a lot of fixed-wing flight time. He wasn't very old, but he could fly a fixed-wing. I mean, you know, he might have been 25 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And your instructor pilot sat in one seat, and you were assigned to another. Unless you were flying an OH-23, then you sat in the middle seat. There was like three seats across. You sat in the middle, and the instructor sat in the left. But he was flying a TH-55 that had a left and right seat. And they, being the Army's Accident Investigation Board, surmised that after he soloed, he was coming back, that he had switched seats to try the instructor seat to see what it would be like to fly from the other side. And before he got back to the airfield, he knew he had to get in the other seat. So instead of landing and changing seats, he tried to do it in midair.
He fell through.
Pardon me?
He fell through.
Yeah, this guy, his name was Brown. And these trainers were so small that you could lean in them and make the thing turn. And as soon as he stepped over from the right to the left side to the right, the aircraft tipped. He was not strapped in. He fell right through the rotor blades. And, of course, that knocked the blades off the TH-55, and he, you know, went in. I think he was the only guy in my class or my section that was killed at Walters that I can remember. Because we had some other guys killed at Rucker, but that was months later.
Did you ever have or know an instructor named Ben Van Etten?
It doesn't ring a bell. In fact, I couldn't tell you the name of any of my instructors from Walters.
Okay.
Then you asked me some of the other aspects about Walters. Once you soloed, which was a great day. They being your other classmates, would take you to some stock tank.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know what they are from mm-hmm. being in Texas, or maybe the pool at the Holiday Inn if you were lucky. And they threw you in with all your clothes on,
right.
And you got to put your you got to sew on your solo wings on your baseball cap, which was the color of whatever walk class you belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started, you know, your instructor would say, okay, you have an hour and a half by yourself today, and you'd go out and do traffic pattern work. Then you'd get signed off for confined areas, which means you'd go out and land to these tires out in the middle of nowhere. And it was just a progression of different maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
Until you graduated, and every so often you had to take a check ride with a check pilot who was not your pilot. I mean, your instructor. You had to take it with some, demonstrate to someone else other than him. And, of course, keep your grades up too.
Well, what was the most challenging aspect of the training for you?
Probably getting to solo, but it didn't take me the 15 hours. I think I ended up soloing like in about 12 hours or 11 or 12. But there was a point where I thought that, you know, I'll never be able to do it. It just, there was too much going on in that little aircraft for me to seem to grasp all at once. But, you know, one day it all kind of came together. And when I soloed, it gave me a lot of confidence.
Okay.
And I wasn't I think I was a little afraid of the aircraft, to tell the truth.
Hmm. Oh, and you were training in?
I trained in a 23, which was an older model than the TH-55. In fact, some units still used them in Vietnam when I got over there the first time, but they had a little more powerful version.
In terms of flying the aircraft, what was hovering the biggest challenge to master?
I'd say so, yeah. Hovering was no picnic. And then, you know, when as time went on, I loved it. You know, I loved hovering. Until the day I stopped flying, I thought that hovering was the greatest thing.
Okay. And, let's see. Any other interesting events occur while you were there at Fort Walters? You mentioned the accident already. I didn't know if there were any humorous stories to relate or...
I'm sure there were, but there was always some type of prank going on.
Okay.
I can't really recollect what they are. The group was close,
mm-hmm.
but one half of the alphabet flew in the morning, and the other half went to school, and then the next week it was vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So one side of the class was always pulling a prank on the other side. The TAC officers, they were ingenious in some of the ways that they came up with the things they did to us. You know, say the night before a big test, this might not be humorous, but, of course, it'd be raining or something, and it'd hit the fire alarm, and you'd run out in your skivvies, and then they'd go an interior room apart. And then, of course, it had to be ready for inspection at 0:30 in the morning, and plus you had a big test. You know, they'd keep you up all night. That's the kind of stuff that would make guys quit. There was a big rock in front of the first walk. I think it was red, and every other class used to go over and paint it their class colors. So our class went over and painted it blue for third walk. I wasn't personally involved in it. But there was always some type of prank. You know, if somebody owned a Volkswagen, you never know where it would end up, anything that they could lift up. But there was a lot of good joking and camaraderie.
Okay. And, for that month that you were still stuck there before you went on to Fort Rucker, what did you do? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember that real well because it was a good month. Everybody was... We were taken to some briefing room, and we were all assigned to a job. And, they said, you, DeMilo, you go with report to Major so-and-so at such-and-such a building. So I went over there, and this Major is a flight commander, and he takes me out to a stage field. And I'm supposed to just help him in the stage tire, like keeping track of tail numbers and who's where and that. But he had regular people there for that. And actually, these little stage-filled tires were really small. And this guy was a decent guy. I wish I could remember his name. And he looked at me after that day, and he said, do you really think that it's necessary to be here? He says, give me your honest opinion. And I said, no, because we're a little crowded up there, and I just feel like I'm in the way. He goes, you're absolutely right. He says, you go back to those barracks wherever you're living and do whatever you want for the rest of the month. And he said, if anybody asks you what you're doing, you tell them to come and see me. And I had the month off.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And everybody was jealous.
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe two or three other guys, like maybe after a week or two, got off. And... I'd go get a six-pack of beer or something and go down to this mineral well. I think it was Mineral Wells Lake right there. And and I had bought a BB gun. And because I didn't have a car, I left my car at home because the Army said, don't bring your car to be a hardship, which is crap. That is the best thing anybody could do is take a car to flight school because you could hide all kind of stuff in your trunk that you didn't want the TAC officers to see. So I didn't have one, but I could walk there from the barracks. And I'd just plink at the beer cans. I'm not a bird shooter, or, you know, I don't, you know, pull the wings off of bugs or stuff. But, you know, I'd plink with the BB gun and drink a cold six-pack, and that was about it. At the end of the day, guys would start shouldering back. Some of my buddies who knew where I'd be, they'd come down in their car, pick me up, say, let's get something, you know, go to the mess hall, get something to eat, go to the drive-in or something like that, you know, play cards. Mm-hmm. So it was a real good month.
Sounds like it. When you said that you could hide things in your trunk that you wouldn't want your TAC officers to find, what kind of stuff do you mean?
We had a locker in our room called a security locker. It was the only thing that you were allowed to keep locked. However, they could have a security locker inspection. Say you hadn't done your, there was only supposed to be so much laundry in your laundry bag. You know, you couldn't let it build up for a long time. You're only supposed to have one extra set of boots, and you were supposed to change your boots every other day. Well, you could buy more than one set and keep them polished. And these boots were numbered, so they could look inside and see your name and a number to know, you know, today you should have boot pair number one on. Tomorrow you better have two on. And one better be shining under the bed. Well, you could keep two extra pair up in your locker and keep switching those, you know, and just give the ones, and just keep wearing the ones that you have on. You know, you'd shine them, but you'd just wear those every day because it was easier to take care of one pair of boots. You could keep all that crap, you know, and put some food up in there, canned food or crackers or something, up in that security locker. Well, if they had a security locker inspection and found all this contraband, you're in trouble. You know, it's demerits. You're not going to get a weekend pass. Well, you could take it out to the trunk of your car and put it in there. And they never, for some reason, they never bothered your car. Just like the married guys. They, you know, they had, their wives did all the ironing, you know, for their uniforms had to be perfect and everything were. Single guys had to take them to the laundry, which cost money, or iron it up yourself if you could iron. So the security locker came in handy until they had the surprise inspection. Just like your razor blade had to be perfectly clean. You know, I mean, to the point of it was ridiculous. And, you know, you could take the razor that you used every day and put it up in your security locker and keep the perfectly new one on display.
Mm-hmm.
That type of stuff. Yeah. Or put it in the trunk of your car or whatever.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Shortcuts.
What's that?
Things that would allow you to make shortcuts. It'd make your day easier. Not bad stuff. Just things that would make your life a little bit easier.
Well, I had this trick. This locker was a built. These were old Air Force barracks, and to the Army, they were, you know, they were like heaven. And they weren't wooden barracks. I didn't live in wooden barracks. When I went through, there was four walks, and there were four concrete block barracks with three floors on them. And they had these built-in wall lockers. They were made of wood, and they had an open like an armoire, where you could hang your uniforms, a security locker on the top, and on the bottom there was about three or four drawers. And there was a walk guide on how everything had to be put in those lockers, and how everything had to be folded, how your socks had to be rolled a certain way, your underwear. And this stuff was all supposed to be used. And there was paper down inside, you know, the locker, shelf paper. So I got the in for inspection every morning. Each drawer had to be, the top drawer had to be out maybe 3 inches, the next drawer 5 inches, and so on and so forth. So I got the idea that I taped, took real small pieces of tape, and I taped everything into position by making a loop of tape. And because the tacks would like to go by, tack officers, and slam these doors shut, and then everything would move. And it would take, 20 minutes or so to get all this rearranged. Well, when I had everything taped, they could slam it shut, and they never used to open it up again, and everything stayed in place. Now, that went on for, I got away with that for a couple of months. And I never said anything to anybody. You know, that was another thing. I mean, we were a tight-knit group. But if you found something pretty good, you better be real good friends with who you said something to. Because somebody might say something by accident, just saying, I heard about this real good plan DeMilo's doing. The next thing you know, this guy's doing it, that guy's doing it. And the TAC officer finds out. I never said anything to anybody, but one day the TAC officer, I guess, got mad that my drawers were always perfect. And he pulled the drawer all the way out and went to dump it out, and nothing fell out. And it was all sort of taped into place. Well, I ended up, I don't think I got a pass for like 2 weeks over that.
For criminal law.
I always said if I flunk out, I could get a job at Bell Helicopter as a gardener. I ended up cutting grass and hedges for 2 weeks on a weekend.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, what was, when you left Fort Walters, is that when you received your chief warrant officer ranking, or was that, when did you receive that?
When we graduated from Fort Rucker, we graduated as warrant officer one. That's not a, not a chief. We got our rank in a ceremony at the Post Theater, and then because you have to have the rank of an officer to get wings, and then we went outside and pinned our wings on, and went back into our original seats, and then pinned our bars on, had another ceremony. And, went across the stage and were issued our wings and then went outside and pinned our wings on. So that all happened at the same time.
I see. Well, what, you were trained on Hueys at Fort Rucker?
At Rucker, we went into OH-13s. We were never checked out in them, but we were given basic instruments in those aircraft, which is a very strange thing, is not to be checked out in an aircraft, but you're flying IFR or... If you know what that is, it's instrument flight rules. You're in the clouds. So the instructor pilot, because he's checked out in the aircraft, you don't have to be. But that's where our basic instruments were taken. And then we went switched to the UEs and went to advanced instruments, and we still weren't checked out in the UE. And then we went when we got instrument training out of the way, I guess the way they looked at it is they weren't going to spend any money on transitioning us into a UE if we couldn't fly instruments, because instruments was the most difficult part of the course, as far as I was concerned, over the overall course. And once you got through instruments, then we were checked out in the UE, and that was, to me, a lot of fun, getting a UE check out. I lucked out and got, I had one, my IP had one student, it was me, a real nice captain. And so we got to spend a little more time flying than the guys who might, an instructor pilot who might have two students or three students. And I guess because of this guy's rank, he just, he was assistant flight leader. He only had to do one student. And so he wouldn't, if we flew, say, 2 hours, he might log 1.5. so I was getting extra time, even though it didn't show up on the books. And it was a lot of fun, though. We did a lot of auto rotations, engine off landings and stuff, and had a good time.
What was the most challenging part of transitioning to Hueys?
They were like, for me, there wasn't anything challenging with the Huey. I think maybe just getting used to the size as far as when you had a tight spot to put it in. Mm-hmm. You know, because all the other aircraft were so small that we were flying. And I really don't consider that so much the challenge as it was using the right judgment. It was you know, getting into going from a Model T to a Cadillac. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very easy to fly once you had that much experience.
And what model Huey was it, do you recall?
We were flying mostly A models and a few B models.
Okay.
And I think when we got on the gunnery range, a few of us got to go on a gunnery range, and I just think it was an arbitrary pick. And I got to go on a gunnery range for a day or two, and there might have been a couple C models on the gunnery range. But we didn't have any C models for just our flight training.
Okay. And was there a very high washout rate there at Fort Rucker?
You know, we lost most of the people already. The majority of the people we lost, and I know we started out with close to like 300 guys. And I can't remember what we graduated with, but we lost most of them at Fort Walters. And, you know, I'm not even sure about the 300, but we had ours was a large class at the time. And but most of the guys were lost that got out or didn't make it were at Walters. And we lost a few at Rucker, but usually at Rucker they gave the guys an opportunity to be set back in class because they had so much money invested in them.
Mm-hmm. And how would you evaluate overall the instructors? Now, and just out of curiosity, before that question, you had a military, an officer instructor there at Fort. At Fort Rucker. What about at Fort Walters? Did you have a civilian instructor, or?
I had two civilians for two different phases, and the last phase at Walters, I had a captain.
Okay.
And then at Rucker, in the primary instrument phase, I had a civilian, and then the rest of advanced phase instruments and my UE transition were both captains in the Army. So it really was a hit or miss type thing.
Well, how would you evaluate the instruction that you received to fly helicopters at both locations?
Are you saying between the difference between the military and the civilian, or?
Oh, no, just were the instructors good, bad?
Overall, I'd rate them good. I only had problems with one instructor. We always were told that if you're not getting along with your instructor, or if you feel you need a change, there's a personality clash, you can ask for a change in instructors, and it won't be held against you. And they really pounded that home. They said, don't get washed out because you're having a personality problem. He said that, you know, they told us that. They're not going to be in any way penalized.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that true?
Yeah. I had a problem with my instructor with advanced instruments. And I just, I couldn't, you know, this guy just was not getting through to me, and I said, well, I'm not going to wash out because of him. Plus, he'd like to hit you on a helmet, you know, and scuff the back of your neck when you're trying to fly and that. I said, hey, I don't have to take this crap from anybody. And I went in and And I was falling behind. And I got a couple pink slips. You get three pink slips, and they put you up for you get a slip every day on your, like, it's like a report card every day you fly. You get three pink slips in a row, and they put you up for an evaluation ride. And there's been guys, that, like especially at Fort Walters, that were thrown out of the program after they had three pink slips and then took an evaluation ride and flunked it, and they were gone. So I said, I want to change an instructor, and they gave me this guy. Now, I remember his name. His name was Captain Runk, and he looked like the hardest, meanest guy on the face of the earth. And he always had a scowl on his face. Got him in the cockpit, smooth, low-talking guy, everything under control. What a nice guy. Had me over his house a couple of times to study, and I think I got I was hoping I could just pass the check ride, like with maybe a 70 or 72 or something like that, and I think I got a 94 on my check ride. After, you know, with the change of instructor.
Yeah.
And he instilled a lot of confidence in me.
Yeah.
And that's the only time that I had a problem. But, you know, other guys did it too. It wasn't it wasn't real common, but it wasn't uncommon at all.
Yeah. But for the most part, you feel like you had good instructors?
Yeah, I do. I think that the civilians were... most of the civilians were a lot older, you know, had done their 20 and or 25 or 30 years in the Army. They were pretty much old school, and I don't think they were as, I'm looking for the right word. I think they looked at it more of an assembly line thing, and most of our instructors had been to Vietnam in the early days flying, and I think they had a feeling of what we were getting into because the things were escalating, and I think that the military instructors were a little maybe easier on us, or not to say that they're letting guys slide through that shouldn't, but had a little better technique at teaching us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, did you know where you were going upon graduation at Fort Rucker?
Yes, I was on orders to the 1st Air Cav Division, and that's exactly where I went. And everybody said, you know, you're look out if you're going to the Cav. It was supposedly, I'm sure that through your interviews you've heard a lot about the 1st Cav.
Yes, sir.
And I was glad to be going there. I wanted to go to a unit that was going to, that had a good reputation. And, but I have since found, I still feel that 1st Cav is the ultimate. But I've since found, or learned to have respect for everybody else that served there too, that we weren't the only people in the war. You know, everybody had their bad day at Black Rock.
Now, during training at Fort Rucker, did you also get any kind of weapons training?
Would you say that again?
Did you get any kind of weapons training? Did you receive?
Did you talk in personal? Talking personal or the aircraft?
Aircraft weapon systems.
Yeah, I mentioned before that I believe it was just a random choosing out of the class. They didn't have time to send everybody through a weapons training program. Plus, it was expensive to shoot the ammunition up. And they only had X amount of gunships set up there at Rucker. And I was fortunate enough to get, I think, 2 days on the gunnery range. But like I said, it was just a hit-or-miss thing. I think they just said, you know, they probably just took every 10th guy and said, you're going to weapons training. And it was, I wouldn't say it helped me one bit in Vietnam.
Okay.
Just all it did was familiarize me a little bit with the weapon system and how it worked, but not so much on how to use it
right.
and become proficient with it.
Right. No. When did you graduate from Fort Rucker?
March 13th of 1967.
Okay. And when did you report into the first cab?
I got to Vietnam on April 3rd. And I was in the cab on by the 5th of April, I believe.
Okay.
We were down at I believe it's the 40th replacement depot in Long Bin or something like that. It's where we all came into. There was a lot of guys from my class, you know, and all we were really waiting to. Some guys weren't on orders to any unit. From there, they were assigned to different units. And the guys from the cab were just waiting for a ride north to get to On K, the base camp.
Okay. When in training, did they go over any kind of any specific techniques or ways that you could fly to avoid enemy contact? You know, were they in training at Rucker, were they gearing you towards combat in Vietnam and things that you can do to increase your survivability?
Yes, we spent the last several weeks in a tactical mode. We went to a place called TAC-X, and we lived out of tents, and two pilots were assigned an aircraft. And you asked me before what models I flew. There might have been some D models out there. But we had no instructors in the aircraft with us, and we were expected to perform missions simulated missions like we were in Vietnam. And we did everything ourselves. And our flight lead was picked arbitrarily. They'd say, okay, your flight lead today. They'd say, okay, a siren or something would go off, would run to our aircraft, crank them up, everybody would fall out into takeoff, how we'd take off and then form up into formation and do a simulated mission. In some places they had infantry waiting for us to pick up and drop and take them to another place, drop off. Sometimes we went up at altitude, sometimes we navigated low level.
Mm-hmm.
So they did prepare us for that. They gave us a lot of classes on, what altitudes to fly to avoid certain type of enemy fire, small arms or 50 caliber, those type of things. And if you did get into gunships, they explained, the trajectory of aircraft, especially, when you're firing in a turn, it affects your bullets or your rockets. So, yes, they did prepare us for that. And we also had a survival course that lasted several days, which accumulated in a they chased us around the woods and swamps all night trying to avoid being captured, and had to, live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that that's another little trick I did, was made sandwiches and stuck them down in my pants, where your pants are bloused at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get maybe six sandwiches or on a bun down in there, wrapped up real good, so I wasn't hungry. Or they gave you a live chicken or something to cook.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I missed anything by not eating the live chicken. We were cooking it up, and that's, of course, when they attacked us.
Yeah. Did you share your sandwiches?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I certainly did.
Okay.
I shared. I had two, and I shared the other four.
Okay. When you left Fort Rucker and were on your way to Vietnam, or were getting ready to go to Vietnam, How confident did you feel? Did you feel like you were prepared? You were ready?
Yeah, I thought that overall that flight school was good, and I was confident. I knew I could fly the aircraft. you know, in the Army said I could. And I watched, you know, other guys fall by the wayside. So evidently, you know, they felt that I had what it took to fly the aircraft. Now I had to prove whether I could do it in combat. So that was the only question I had was, you know, then what was combat going to be like? You know, getting shot at that. But I was confident that I could fly the aircraft. And that was my main mission because I knew they wouldn't. Now, they told us that they wouldn't put you there by yourself, I mean, or with somebody that wasn't experienced. You know, you'd get there and you'd fly with an experienced guy for a while to teach you all the little tricks.
Right. Okay. And how did you travel over to Vietnam?
It was commercial. They had a, you know, how they the military rents. Pardon me?
Yes, sir. They rent a commercial aircraft?
Yeah, it was one of those Flying Tigers or something like that, you know,
okay.
These off-the-wall outfits that transfer troops are probably using them today to get the guys over in the Gulf.
Okay. Well, if you would, why don't you go ahead and describe the trip over and you know what the atmosphere was like on the aircraft? And then your first impressions upon landing in Vietnam.
Okay. It was a little different, I think, than maybe some pilots that went over, how I should put it. I'm sure a lot of classes met up. Half of my class that graduated went to Vietnam, and I believe the other half, those are relative figures. Was sent to Fort Knox to form up one of the air cavalry squadrons. So the half that went directly to Vietnam, we all had orders to get there the same day. We showed up in San Francisco, and then we were headed to Travis Air Force Base. So we all got to Travis at around the same time. You had to take a bus up there. But there was some problem either with the aircraft or a storm in the Pacific, and we did not take off on time. And the airline put us up in some hotel. The only problem was is there were so many of us that, you know, we had to get some fold-out beds, which was okay. And in this area was a wine country, and we didn't have any transportation. So we just went to these little wineries and walked the road, and they had wine and cheese for you. And as soon as they saw us that we were going to Vietnam, they said, you know, help yourself. So we had free wine and cheese for about a day and a half, and everybody was pretty lit. And the aircraft was finally repaired. The storm was over, and we headed for Vietnam. We believe we stopped at Hawaii for fuel. And it was we were allowed to get off the plane but not go into the airport because all they did was fuel the aircraft and go, and they didn't want anybody to, wander off and miss the plane. Then I believe we stopped in the Philippines. And they told us the same thing. We're just going to refuel the plane and go. And it was daylight then. The ride over was fairly uneventful. I'm sure there was some anxiety, but most of the guys were pretty calm. I think the flight training had something to do with that. Being through what we had gone through in flight training, and a couple of guys had some. Alcohol on board, you know, some of them were drunk, some of them, most of the guys weren't, but I mean, no, there was no problem. Nobody caused a scene or anything like that. And what I do remember is when we stopped in the Philippines and they did say, you know, don't wander away. Well, three guys grabbed a cab and took off for the officers' club. They're officers now and they wanted to use their newfound power to get in an officer's club, and the plane left without them. You know, I mean, when it was done, we just took off and they were gone. And everybody thought, well, just like in flight school, these guys are in trouble. Heck, they caught up to us in Vietnam, a day or two later. Nobody even said a word to them because they just went to the replacement company, and mm-hmm. So they got a couple of days off in the Philippines. And that's what, it was the flight over, and then hanging around that reception station was one thing that was odd was that kind of brought it home was when you open that door, and I've read a lot about this. When they opened the door to the aircraft, I've heard a lot of guys say the same thing. It was that country has its own smell to it, and the heat, you know, was just devastating. And I believe we landed at Benoit or Tonsonut, one of the two, and it just hit you like a ton of bricks. And we got on a school bus, but it had wire mesh along the windows, so I guess they couldn't pitch a grenade in. But nobody paid a lick of attention to us. We just drove through a third world country, through the streets to get to this replacement repo depot, as we called it, and it was very uneventful, just hot, and I'm sure everybody was hungry because they gave us some type of terrible box lunches on the plane, and we hung around there for maybe a day or two. I can't remember exactly. It wasn't real long, and it was filthy. The latrines, you can't imagine the smell. Take a latrine smell and intensify it with heat, and I don't think you can get anything any worse. And there was kind of gutters with in this repo depot with like the wash water and stuff running through it, and it would sit in pools, and the mud in Vietnam had its own smell. And they just gave you, they said you're assigned to this building, and you just picked out, they had a mattress on a military bunk. And there were, the buildings were wood partially way up and then screened, and so the red dust was on everything. And I can't remember if they gave, I think they gave us a couple of sheets, but they were dirty too. And then at night, that night we spent there, you could hear artillery fire and machine gun, but way off in the distance. But it was kind of like, it kind of woke you up a little bit that I guess there is something going on. But you come to learn later on that every place in Vietnam fired artillery and machine guns at night for H&I fire. And I'm sure down there, Long Binh was one of the most secure places during the war. So we later found out it was nothing, and you could tell that it was way off, probably miles. But at the time, you don't know any better, and you just kind of wonder what's going on. So I found it difficult to sleep that night with the heat and the dirt, and there was an officers' club there that you could, in the afternoon, the afternoon that we spent there, to get a beer. And then all of a sudden, somebody came around and said, whoever's going to the cab, get on the back of this truck, get your duffel bag and let's go. Mm-hmm. And it was late in the day. So they took us to some airfield. I have no idea because it was dark when we got there. And got onto a C-130. There were no seats. Just threw your duffel bag down on the floor and flopped on top of it. And we were taught, in flight school, there's a weight and balance and that you have to do, and everybody has to be strapped in. Well, there was none of that. Just get on, and they went. And do you have anything else you want to know about that particular part?
Well, when you got there, you knew you were going to a specific unit?
Yeah, I told you I was on orders to the
first
air
cab,
right?
And what about the subordinate unit within the first air cab?
Because
you were assigned to Delta
229,
right?
Well, I wasn't assigned down that far.
Oh, okay.
Everybody was just assigned to the first cab, and then it came later on where you were going. But it was interesting. We landed at Play Coup. And got on a smaller, off of that plane, and got on a C-123, which was a smaller plane, and flew over on a 23 from Play Coup to On K. It might have been a half-hour flight. And as we were getting, it was late at night. I have no idea, but it was, you know, dark. It could have been 10 o'clock. It could have been 2 in the morning. I have no idea. But as we got off of that plane, and it was, there wasn't a lot of light around. They were putting wounded on it. You could see the blood coming through the bandages in body bags. And that really, I mean, everybody that I talk to that I see at flight school reunions or Vietnam Helicopter Pilot Association reunions or whatever, we always kind of bring that up. You know, remember when we got off the plane, how they were putting those dead guys on. And then we were taken to a replacement depot within the CAV and assigned a cot in some dirty tent, and then we were mortared, not we personally, but on K. They mortared what they call the golf course where they parked all the helicopters. And we watched gunships and flare ships. The flare ships, of course, or artillery flares, some type of flare was going off at night, and the gunships shooting their miniguns and rockets down into suspected enemy positions. And they weren't far from, real far from where we were. Somebody came and got us and said, get out of the tent and go out and lay in these weeds and some slit trenches that were out there. So it was, you know, kind of wake up of a night, watching the bodies and the wounded and then the mortar attack. And we got up the next morning. I don't know if anybody slept after that. And we were taken to a room that wasn't a building not far from these tents, and that's where we were assigned to the different units. And I think they asked who wanted to fly medevac, and some guys put up their hands, and they kind of like gave you what you wanted if they could, you know, this major from personnel. And he said, if you really want a lot of action and there's a good chance that you'll be wounded or killed, is you want to go to the 1st Squadron, 9th Cavalry. And I put my hand up, and this is the truth. A friend of mine, Carl Crow, is a lawyer in Houston now, and another guy, grabbed the other arm and pulled them down and said, we heard about the 1st or 9th, you'll get killed over there. I said, and I'm struggling with them in this room. But a lot of guys had put their hands up, and the major just counted it out and said, okay, you guys are going to the 1st or the 9th. And they just said, okay, you guys are going to 227th, you guys are going to the 229th. I got stuck going to the 229th. Somebody sent a truck over to pick us up. And then we went to another personnel office in the 229th, the adjutant's office, and just a clapboard building. And the guy just lined us up and said, you three are going to A, you four are going to B, you two were going to C, and you two, there was only two of us that were going to D. And I was kind of downtrodden because I thought flying in the 1st or the 9th, I'd have a chance to fly gunships, which I wanted to do. And the guy that held my arm down, Carl Crow, said, he grabbed my arm, he squeezed it real hard, he says, we got guns. I said, how do you know that? He said, I saw a sign as that we were pulling in here that said Delta Company is a gun company. So I was pleased that I was going to fly gunships, and that's how I ended up in the Delta 229.
Okay. What kind of, when you got to the first CAF, what kind of briefings did you get?
Now, that major sent us, we had some paperwork to fill out, about like if you're lightly wounded, do you want anybody at home to know? You know, most of the guys put no, if you know, for a light wound, you know, some typical things for pay and that. And then we had to go to what you called charm school. Everybody had to go. It didn't matter if you were a pilot or an infantryman. and it was anything but charm school, but they wanted everybody to be familiar with a weapon and how to throw a grenade and shoot a grenade launcher. And so I think sometime that day they took us out to what they called the green line, which was the perimeter. There was a big bunker right outside the green line at the at some position that had been attacked the night before when that mortar attack was going on. There was blood all over the place. The thing had been blown to shit. It was still smoking. And we're looking around like, they have us out here, and we're all green, you know, troops. And we shot weapons and threw some grenades and shot M79s and, you know, familiarized with an M16, which most of us never fired before. And then we were sent back to our, the next day we were supposed to go out again, and all the pilots just said, hell on it, we're not going. But they made sure that the infantry went. And then we caught a ride out to the Bong Son plane at LZ English with a maintenance aircraft from Delta 229th. And it was about a 45-minute flight out to English. And that's really where we basically operated out of. So On K was just a base camp.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you go ahead and if you would describe the morale of the unit. How many, did you get into a gunship right when you got there?
Yes.
That kind of stuff.
As soon as I got there, I couldn't really gauge the morale because I didn't have a chance to talk to anybody. We moved from On K was sat up on a high plateau, maybe 1,500 feet above sea level, maybe 1,500 feet above sea level, and it was much cooler up there. This is cool in terms of Vietnam. I mean, it was still hot, but when we got down to English, it was sea level. And it was really hot, and my buddy and I, this guy Crow, could not, because we had gone through flight school together from day one. We could barely catch our breath, and they said, "Yeah, go sit in this tent." So we did what anybody told us to do. You know, we just went and sat in this tent, and somebody from operations came over with two cold Coca-Colas. I don't know where he got them, but they were. You know, they were like lifesavers. So we're drinking the Coke, and this tall, thin Texan, I knew he was a Texan because, you know, when he started to talk, draw on that, he's a captain, and he comes over to the tent, and he peeks in, and he said, "Which one's," you know, everybody says, "DeMilio." I says, "Me," and he said, "Oh," and he's got some big expletive, I got the short one, and he said, "Let's go get your helmet." I haven't been there. I've been there long enough to drink a Coke, and it didn't fill out any paperwork, nothing like that. And he says, "We're going flying." And this guy was my platoon leader. His name's Edwin Richter. He's living in San Antonio now. He was a retired lieutenant colonel, one of the finest men I ever met in my life. And He took me out in a loaded gunship. We were by ourselves, and he was also the unit instructor pilot, and he wanted to see if I could fly or what my capabilities were. And we did touchdown auto rotations. Those are, you know, engine off landings, right to the ground, right to dry rice paddy, slope landings, every maneuver that's in your book, that's in the book for a check ride. And this is with a loaded ship, and I've never done this with a loaded aircraft, so everything had to be a little more fine-tuned than anything we did at flight school. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and he was pleased with what I did. And then he took me up into a free fire zone, and we started to picked out this hooch that was way back in this clearing in the jungle up near the Onlo Valley, and we started shooting at it. And I I could barely hit the ground with the rockets. And the door gunners were having a good time because they could twist their door guns and they could put hot brass right down your neck. And he was chuckling. He says, you'll learn to fly with your collar up and buttoned in the gunship. Because they didn't have, they had free guns on a gunship. They didn't have them on a pole, as we call a pussy pole, like the slicks did. But that's because they had to throw things out, help troops in and out, where we didn't have to do that. So they could tilt that gun and make the hot brass go anywhere. And that was my first day, and I flew with him every day for a month after that. And if he had a night mission, which my company did, we had a night mission every night. We had a patrol where the 1st of the 9th left off in the daytime on recon. My unit picked up at night, and we patrolled the rivers around that area and certain hot spots. You know, the division decided this is where they wanted us to look. And I flew with him because he wanted me to pick up his habits. And he felt that his habits were the best. And I believe that's what kept me alive to this day, was that flying with him for a month. And we got a lot of hours, and he showed me every trick in the book.
Okay.
And I felt that the morale in that unit was excellent. Our commander, Ira Jones, was a good man, was a major.
Mm-hmm.
And the morale was just, I think, was as good as I had ever seen it for the rest of the year.
Now, when you first went out that first time, that you didn't encounter any enemy.
No. But that doesn't mean...
Oh, no,
that we couldn't have been shot at any time,
absolutely.
You know. But, well, we didn't encounter everything. It was just a free ride,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was a lesson.
Right.
And but if we would have seen some, I'm sure that he would have taken the controls or the gun, whatever he wanted to fire, rockets or the minigun, and he would have done something about it.
Right. During those flights, in that first month where you were flying with him, do you remember any particular lessons that he invoked, told you about, things that that would help you stay alive as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam? Anything in particular coming to mind?
Yeah, the first time I got shot at was at night, and we were going, they like to play at this time of the day, but it's so cold outside, they came in to play, my dogs.
Right, right.
So they're having their little tussle. I got shot. We were out on the Bong Son plane going near a plate. We were cutting across from into the Arvin area of operation. The 40th Arvin was east of Highway 1, and we started taking 50 caliber fire. And you could tell it's 50 because the tracers are so big and they're reaching up to the altitude we were at, because we were going to let down it over the coast and work the mouth of the Bong Son River and get, you know, right down on the deck. So as we are moving from one area over to the other, we started taking fire, and I could see the tracers coming up by the ship, but they weren't hitting us, but it certainly scared me. And I started to pull in more power to try to climb away from them, and I start sucking off rotor RPM and engine RPM, almost to where we got the low audio warning, and Captain Richter didn't holler at me or anything. He just said, "Hey Al," and he tapped over on it. I could see in the light of the cockpit, you know, he tapped at the RPM, and we were down to 6,000, where we usually run at 6,600. He said, just put it back to, you know, where it's supposed to go. It'll climb without us sucking all the RPM off of it. And, you know, it taught me that when you get in a tight situation, which that wasn't even tight compared to some things that happened later on, you got to keep your wits about you. You still have to fly the aircraft. No matter what's going on,
Yeah. You
have to fly that aircraft. And as you get more experience, it becomes second nature, as you've heard guys say. I'm sure that you strap it on, and that it becomes part of you. But I learned that fly the aircraft, watch what you're doing, don't kill yourself in an accident. Mm. And once he and I got in the clouds, there was a big assault. The Cav was crazy. They assaulted constantly, putting troops in, day, night, didn't matter when. We put a big assault in on a Bong Son plane, and the weather was just horrendous. And we popped into the clouds at about 1,000 feet en route to where this assault was going to take place that we were going to cover. And then we were popping in and out, in and out. Could see the ground for a while, couldn't see the ground. And then we start taking machine gun fire from several locations. And it was and because our ship was on the outside of the formation covering the slicks, it was the closest one to the enemy fire, and they were directing their fire at us. And it was another time where I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to continue on covering the slicks or to dive down and attack the guns. You know, I was stymied. And he says, you know, and he swore at, he did, he was mad then, and he swore at me, and he took the aircraft, and he says, we're here to protect those slicks, and we dove down through the clouds, because we could see in and out. It wasn't solid clouds, but it wasn't by any means, it got my heart rate up, mm-hmm. And we attacked, he attacked the guns. And he said, just don't sit there, do something, you know. So it was this decision was not to fly the aircraft, but, crap or get off the pot. Do something about it. But he got mad about that. And he says, we'd already been flying together for a couple of weeks when that happened, but we hadn't been in any bad weather.
Okay.
But I learned something there.
Yeah. No, when you were flying in at night like that, this was a night mission.
Yes.
When you were flying at night, did you have any kind of lights on whatsoever, were you completely blacked out?
On that particular mission, we had our lights on because of the enemy wanted to shoot into any, we had the doctrine. They would rather have the enemy shoot at the gunship than the lesser armed slicks. You know, the slicks had a machine gun on each side, and their job was to get, you know, their troops on the ground. Plus, they have troops on board.
Mm-hmm.
So, also, the weather was so bad at that particular time, and there were so many aircraft in the air. I think we had 24 slicks and six or eight gunships with them. Plus ARA birds, aerial rocket artillery, that we had to be able to try to see one another. There were too many aircraft going on, flying around that nobody could be blacked out. And when we ran missions by ourselves with just two birds and a flare ship, we'd have the lead bird completely blacked, complete lights on, and the trail bird completely blacked out. So, yeah, our lights were on that mission. It depended on what kind of mission and the number of aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what was this? This was a mission into the Bong Son plane?
Yes.
Was this the first major combat assault you participated in?
Well, no.
Why don't you go ahead and describe your first major combat mission?
The one that there could have been others. But when you say major, I'm going to say more than a regular one, and usually involved six slicks, two gunships, and two aerial rocket artillery birds.
Okay.
That was your normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill, moving troops around. Once you started getting up around 12 aircraft or 24 aircraft, they became pretty big, and they're usually, the higher-ups, decided to do that, they're usually expected to trouble, or there was some type of large enemy force. And I remember going into the Onlow Valley, which was just a mountain range over the mountains, to the west of Bongsan, and it was a real bad place when we first got there, when I first got there. And it was even worse, you know, before I got there, obviously. And we flew 24 slicks into there, maybe more, a minimum of 24. I know just about the whole battalion took place because I think we had a maximum effort to try to get all 12 of our gunships up. And our battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel, was leading the flight. So when you usually have the battalion CO leading a flight, it's a pretty big operation, mainly because if there's medals going to be given out, they'll get one, you know. But this guy wasn't a bad guy, though. He led a lot of flights. And it was in the Onlow. And by this time, Captain Richter was letting me fire the rockets, and he used the miniguns in the left seat. And I was punching off the rockets, and we were down real low, right, skimming the trees and shooting them kind of line drive along the side of the slicks. And there were still buildings left in the Onlow. When we left there, the place looked like it was nuked. It was completely defoliated. All the buildings had been bulldozed. Mm-hmm. There was nothing left. But there was still a village in there, and or a town. And he said, "You're getting kind of close to that lead ship." He said, "You ought to shut it off, you know." And I punched one more. And when I hit this, I did hit the hooch, but it was just luck. But when it blew up right next to the lieutenant, the battalion commander's aircraft. And Ed Richter said, "Oh, crap, you did it now. You got the colonel." Mm-hmm. And he said, "The colonel, you had to blow the colonel, you know, out of the air or he's touching down." And well, when all the dust settled and we come buzzing by, because we were at a distance behind him, the colonel's aircraft was still intact, and he came out. And that evening, later on that evening, after the operations were done, Richter says, "You got to go to the squad, go up to, not squadron, but up to battalion headquarters. The colonel wants to see you." Well, they had set me up. It was like I was going to get a big ass chewing, but it was just all in good fun. Mm-hmm. But they just had me sweating it out.
Mm-hmm.
It actually, it turned out to be an excellent rocket shot, but it was just real lucky. That was the first real big assault that I was on. And you had to be careful with those gunships. The Richter was so good, he picked up, somebody gave him the nickname the Baby Jesus. And that's how he's, if you've mentioned that to any of the guys from Delta 229, they know exactly who you're talking about.
Well, that's, how did he earn that nickname, do you know?
Because he was so good. Mm-hmm. He was the best gun pilot in Delta 229.
Okay.
And, you know, what's better than the Baby Jesus?
Yeah.
So that's who he was, the Baby Jesus.
Well, I didn't know if perhaps he survived some kind of horrendous situation, like a miracle.
No.
That way, a miracle was involved.
I'm sure he survived some hairy times, but
right.
He was a great pilot, great instructor, and,
right.
and a great guy. Yeah. And I'm still in touch with him.
Okay. Well, that area in which you were operating, what was your primary responsibility, the unit's primary responsibility? What were you guys trying to accomplish there? And this is all in Two Corps, correct?
Yes, this was in Two Corps. This was in Northern Two Corps. The first cab was working from, well, we always had somebody around the base camp at Onkay, and then we started at a place somewhere around Phuket, which was an Air Force base, just above Quinyon, and worked all the way to the I Corps border, which was up around Duk Pho, and then west some distance. I can't really. About to a place called the Songri Valley. And our job was to, you know, find the enemy and kill them. And we basically fought an outfit called the 22nd NVA Regiment that was that moved around that area quite a bit. And that's usually who we fought. Now, this area, Bongsan, was the largest rice producer in Two Corps. So the enemy got a lot of its supplies out of this Bong Son plain. And it had a, you know, this some of the part of the coast in that country, the mountains come right down to the water, where this had a beautiful plain. I mean, if you ever wanted to set a resort up, the Bong Son plain was absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. But nice and flat, and all kind of rice growing there. And our, you know, our responsibility was to find the enemy and kill him. And usually the first of the ninth were the people that found him, and then would we, the rest of the division, would pile on with regular infantry, and the 229th would bring that infantry and assault them right on top of the enemy.
Okay.
Then my job was to stay there and help the infantry protect the slicks, any logistical support, we'd call log birds, to go in, cover that, cover medevacs, and then my unit at night patrolled the waterways and whatever hot spot that division felt that needed patrolled, and we ran these patrols all night. You could sometimes get 5-6 hours of night flying, and when I first got there, you were usually off the next day, but as time went on and the replacements weren't coming in as fast, you might get to sleep till 10 o'clock the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd be back at it again. But somebody was up all the time, and the weather, I only seen, we called it firefly. A lot of people called it lightning bug, or there were so many different names for it. But I think in a whole year I was there, I think maybe I seen it canceled 5 times. And one time an aircraft crashed going over to POL to refuel. It was raining so hard, and we were begging them to not to send us out. Because nobody can see. You can't see your hand in front of your face.
Mm-hmm.
When the aircraft crashed, hit its tail rotor on a revetment, they called it off. And another time, a guy from my unit, they didn't call it off. He went, this was up at Evans during Tet. He went up into the clouds and went inverted immediately and came out upside down and, you know, crashed and burned. Lieutenant Gary Shy. They were hell-bent for leather to fly at night.
Was your was the unit at full strength?
When I got there, it was. And then after that, as time went on, I don't think it ever was. But it was pretty close. I wouldn't say there was only maybe once or twice that we were really hurting.
Okay.
But it was, I'd say most of the time, we were just maybe running at 85% to 90%.
Okay. And what would you, what do you remember about the operational level of your aircraft fleet? How many did you, were all your aircraft functional? Or did you guys have a certain number that were consistently down? Or?
It was very hard to keep. Helicopters. All we had 12 in our company. The slick companies A, B, and C had 20 apiece. Let me digress here for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Which I had been on 2 assaults. This was, you asked me where my first big assault was, and that was in the Onlo. And but 2 assaults, and I was still flying with Richter.
Mm-hmm.
We had 100 slicks. So we had supporting gunships. For every 6 slicks, there was 2 gunships, 2 ARA birds. We had the guns of go-go, which were the armed Chinooks. We had those particular assaults. We had naval gun support, and we had all these interlocking fire bases firing. But 100 slicks in the air, you should have heard the radios. You couldn't think straight.
Yeah.
But They were, one lands out on Bong Son, and one was up at LZ Glen, was up at the Fishhook in the Onlo Valley. But those were the biggest assaults I was ever on. Never saw anything like that again after that particular time. But the maintenance on a helicopter, you know, you fly it for 1 hour, you've got 2 or 3 hours of maintenance on it. And every 25 hours, they had an intermediate inspection, which could be done in maybe 4 or 5 hours. And then every 100 hours of flight time, it had a periodic inspection, and they took the whole aircraft apart. And if the aircraft didn't have a lot of damage to it, or they didn't find a lot wrong with it, our maintenance people working around the clock in teams could pull it in 24 hours. But most of the time, if it was in what we called PE, that aircraft would be at least 3 days, and sometimes you'd get a hangar queen, it might be in 3 weeks. And so we were, out of those 12 aircraft, we were lucky, I'd say, to keep 8 all the time flying, because something always went wrong with one or, with, you know, with something, or bullet damage or whatever. But I felt that the maintenance was pretty good. I flew civilian for a while. I flew a civilian medevac after I got out of the service. And the civilians can't hold a candle to the military's maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Now, of the aircraft that you would have down, were they principally down for maintenance issues, or because they had been damaged in flight?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last word.
If they were damaged in flight, whether it be combat damage?
I'd say principally for maintenance. We were pretty lucky in Delta 229th about bullet damages. I mean, it's not that we didn't get it, but when I was there, we were pretty good about where we took the hits. It always seemed to be pretty lucky on where we took them. They didn't really tear the aircraft up. But we had a couple that were totally destroyed, you know, from combat damage. But I'd say most of the time the aircraft were down because of maintenance, the majority of them.
Okay.
Just like half of the aircraft in Vietnam that were lost due to accident.
Right.
But, helicopters. I can't speak for the fixed wing.
In the area in which you operated, during the briefings, the pre-mission briefings you'd receive, were the enemy units in the area principally Viet Cong, NVA, or a combination?
I'd say a combination, and our briefings weren't very – when I first got there, you know, hang around operations, look at the situation board and that, after a while, they'd just say, you got to go. And you went – and excuse me, my wife just got home.
Go ahead.
They'd just say, in the morning, sometimes if you're going to do those six ship assaults, you'd get a briefing sheet. You knew where you were going, who you were, what unit you were picking up, and where you were going to take them. Now, that can be diverted any time. And say another unit got in trouble, you could take the people that you were going on a search and destroy mission and put them in over here. And it turns out to be a hot LZ. But most of the time, if you weren't on that, that was your first reaction force. Then you were on second reaction force, and you were pretty much a standby for whatever came up unexpectedly. And you'd end up flying all day. Then your third reaction force was usually the guys that flew the night missions. But they'd end up going out during the day most of the time, too. So that's the briefings, most of the time you got on the radio, you know, you're taken off. And they're saying, head over into the Onlo. Here's the grid coordinates, and this is what's going on. Or there'll be somebody there, or contact Killer Spade, Yellow One, on their UHF frequency, and they'll brief you. Everything was kind of like by the seat of your pants.
Could you get information or intelligence on, let's say you had to go from point A to point B, and it was imperative that you got to point B intact for, you know, whether it be providing, say, support for a slick insertion. Would you be able to get intelligence on what enemy units were in between point A and point B so you could avoid contact, avoid getting in too much trouble?
There was a situation board in operations that was updated as they got information from battalion, and battalion got it from division. And so you could look at your route,
uh-huh,
and see what was in between.
Okay.
There was usually always a lot of small arms fire marked which you didn't worry about. What you worried about was the anti-aircraft, the 50 calibers, is what you worried about, because they could reach you if you were low level, or if you were, you know, they have a range of a mile. So that's what you've, you know, you could stay that. But usually the gunships, we used to skim the trees wherever we went, because we were always looking for trouble, even if we were en route to escort somebody. But usually, if we were going to make an insertion, the slicks and the gunships took off together, because we all lived at the same in the same area, and you know, we'd all leave at the same time. If we went out, if we just went out to help somebody in trouble, you know, like during a Tet Offensive, there were times I'd get shot at and I couldn't stop to shoot back, because it was imperative that I got to the people in trouble, because during Tet, it was always life and death that you got to where, you know, somebody needed you the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you engage in very much, along those lines, so life and death situations, did you engage in very much impromptu medevac, where you were the closest aircraft to the situation? They needed a medevac as soon as possible, so you guys went in?
I personally didn't do it in Delta 229th, but in subsequent tours in the 1st or the 9th I did, but not in Delta 229th.
Okay.
I never had to make a medevac in a gunship. It's very hard to do because of the weight. Even if you expended all your ammo, you still have the weight of the guns and the ammo trays and whatnot, all this extra stuff that you carried on board.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the aircraft wasn't really designed for that. And I'd have to get into aerodynamics and things for you, because it was a different model. Most of them were Charlie models.
Okay. But you had, the Charlie models had decent power, is that correct?
No, I'd say they were underpowered.
They were underpowered.
Yes. They had this big blade on them. They were just like, they had the same weight and max gross weight as an H model, but they had a different rotor system. And the rotor system was built for speed and maneuverability to turn tighter, but it wasn't good for lifting.
Okay.
And where the H model was built for lifting, so how do you get the same amount of weight off with a different rotor system and the same engine?
Mm-hmm.
And it made it difficult. There was times when your door gunner and crew chief had to run alongside you as you hopped down a runway or a road or something to get off the ground, and then they jumped in once you started to fly a little bit. Or you'd have to cut back on your fuel. We had one ship that could only, you know, you could, a Charlie model hold, I think, 1,650 gallons of fuel. And then we had one ship that, pounds of fuel. And we had one ship you could only get off the ground on a real hot day with 600 pounds on it. And you're burnt, you know, every 10 minutes you're burning 100 pounds, so you can't stay up very long. And if you had a long mission, that ship was not the one to take.
No.
But they gave it to you. You know, somebody had to fly it.
Right. So you rotated aircraft. You didn't always fly in the same one.
No, you tried to. We had three platoons. I was in the second platoon. And my favorite ship was 053. It had a 40-millimeter on a nose. It was a rebuilt B model, and it was able to pick up a lot of weight because it had the same rotor system as the H model on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't very fast or maneuverable, but it could pick up what it was supposed to. And I tried to fly that. I was given that aircraft. When it came in, I was a senior aircraft commander in the second platoon. Captain Richter had already gone home, and my new platoon leader, Mel Utley, said, this ship's yours. How do you want it armed? You know, you can have miniguns or 40-millimeter. And I said, I want a 40-millimeter. So that's what they put on it for me. And I try, when that ship was flyable, I flew it. When it wasn't, it was potluck.
Why did you choose the 40-millimeter over the other weapon systems?
I thought really it was a much more versatile weapon, where your minigun didn't have much penetration power into bunkers. They jammed quite a bit. They were good for troops in the open or lightly covered say like hooches and things like that, where they could the regular round could go right through it. And they were good against boats, sandpans, which we did a lot of work at night on. But 40 millimeter could get into a bunker. You know, you can pound a bunker with it and blow a hole in it. Or if you got a round in the door of the bunker, the shrapnel's going to spread through it, where a minigun is probably just going to dig in the dirt, you know, not hurt anybody. I thought it was just trench lines. It was good. You know, just start pumping it right down a trench line, and, you know, guys would just come flying out like you couldn't believe. So that's why I liked it. It was much easier to reload also, much faster to reload. And my crew chief and I got some extra cans from Guns A Go-Go Armed Chinooks, and we were putting 850 rounds on that, which they normally only carry 300. So we wouldn't have to expend this long chute that ran from the back to the front unless it was life or death. And so we could turn that aircraft around real fast because reloading it, the 40-millimeter rounds came in 50-round cases, and the rockets are easy to load. And it was a good aircraft. It was just slow.
Mm-hmm. But I guess for you personally as a pilot, you would prefer an aircraft that had the higher lift capability with that rotor system as opposed to the more maneuverable and faster rotor system.
Absolutely. And I have guys that will argue with me. That'll be when I go to the VHPA reunion this year in Orlando. Mm-hmm. We'll sit down and we'll, you know, and there'll be that same argument across, and we have it every year, you know, but our Charlie model versus the B model.
Uh-huh.
So it's all personal preference.
No, why did you prefer that? Was there anything in particular?
I thought that the I liked the idea that aircraft could get off the ground wherever they put us. We worked on from sea level up into mountains. That we had landing zones and places we got fuel that were 2,500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know if you know much about density altitude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you're up. You know, at density altitude, thinner air, I've been stuck up on one of those places that was refueled, and I couldn't get out of the refueling area because
right.
It was covered with barbed wire or surrounded by barbed wire, and I couldn't get that thing to hover high enough to go over three or four feet of barbed wire.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And I remember the flight leader, who was a major or somebody at the Slicks, was on me pretty good about getting stuck in there.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of lost, you know, that kind of taught me a lesson.
Yeah.
And because I thought I could get an aircraft off of anything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the gunships used to go to the edge of that place. It was LZ Sandra, and it was a cliff right on the edge. And they used to actually jump off of that cliff to get the thing to fly, and that is the truth. Where that B model would pick up to a hover, and you'd go, no
yeah.
matter where you were at.
Yeah.
And but another drawback to it, though, it only carried about... I think it was 1,150 or 1,200 pounds of fuel, but that was usually enough. That's all you could get in it,
mm-hmm.
and that had something to do with it, too. So
that's a lot of flying, isn't it?
You mean time-wise?
Yes.
Yeah, it would give you about an hour and 45 minutes
mm-hmm.
before you go into your 20-minute fuel light.
Okay.
And we used to regularly do that. Is when the light came on, we used to punch our stopwatch, started again, and supposedly you had 20 minutes, but nobody knows for sure if that thing was going to quit flying, engine stop running at 18 minutes, or it's going to fly for 22.
Right.
You know,
right.
it was kind of a fine line there.
Mm-hmm.
So you get, you know, we did all the time. We flew into the light. You knew how where you were at and how long it took to get home. There was nothing about odd about flying 10 minutes into the light. That was commonplace. When you started going 15 minutes into the light, you started stretching it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think the longest I ever went into the light was about 18 minutes. And I was sweating it.
I would imagine. Anybody ever run out of fuel?
I'm sure they did, but nobody in my unit, you know, I heard stories of guys in other units that did, but nobody in my unit ever ran out of fuel because of that.
Okay. How about accidents? In your unit.
Okay, I was never, knock on wood, even though I'm not flying, I was never involved in an accident. However, my first tour, I remember I mentioned we had assaulted a place called Elsie Glen, Landing Zone Glen. We made it the day we put those 100 ships in there. And we were taking off of two gunships, and I was the trail gunship. I hadn't made fire team leader yet. And there were six slicks, so I was the tail end Charlie. And we took off to go pick up some troops, and as soon as we took off, the mission was canceled or put on hold. And they said, well, just come back. The flight lead says, just come back and land here at Glen, and we'll just shut down and wait for the time, you know, the word to go. Mm-hmm. Well, the slicks were all empty, and the gunships were full of ammo. So we had as much fuel as we could carry, and the slicks had as much fuel as they could carry, but no troops. So they didn't have any problem with the landing downwind. And the gunships were fully loaded. And we just followed the slicks in, not thinking about it being downwind. And the ship in front of me couldn't slow, you know, picked up the tailwind and couldn't slow that aircraft down. And he rolled it up. And all I did was pull in power, and I made a go around, you know, and then I came in from the other direction and landed. And they totally destroyed the aircraft, and all four of the crew members got out with just cuts and bruises, you know, stuff that just needed stitched. I don't know how they lived through it, because I know one of the blades, when it hit the ground, came up and it just missed my aircraft. Mm. And then we had one, when we moved north, right after Tet. In fact, one of my best friends was flying the aircraft, and he had brought it up from maintenance at Da Nang, and he had it loaded with beer and had an engine failure as he was going in the pole, refueling at about 15 feet, and he just spread the skids on it. The aircraft wasn't destroyed, but there was a lot of damage, and the colonel wanted to know if there was, you know, if he was loaded with beer, because there shouldn't have been that much damage from 15 feet, and it was kind of muddy, so he knew it was loaded with something. But of course, the first thing we did was get a truck down there and get the beer unloaded.
So you had your priorities correct.
Of course.
Yeah. How available was beer and alcohol?
We weren't allowed to have beer my first tour on a fire base. You could drink it back at liquor. You could drink it back at On K, but you weren't allowed to have it at the fire bases. But somebody would manage to have a bottle once in a while. But we could get beer at the fire bases. In fact, at the company, there was like, I don't know, after the evening meal, they had like, the supply shed would open up and it'd sell beer for 10 cents a can. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't flying tomorrow or the next day or something, you know, nobody gave a darn if you drank too much. Mm-hmm. And then it got to be where everybody drank pretty much mm-hmm. in the evening, whether they were flying the next day or not. Okay. And as long as you could get to the aircraft and weren't dangerous, nobody said anything. And it got to bed at a decent time. Mm-hmm. And it usually it didn't take much, because you were so tired, you know. Yeah. You'd have three or four beers, and it was like drinking, you know, two six-packs now.
Right.
And we also had, you asked me about other missions, is we also had Delta 229, the whole 229th, and there was a sister battalion, the 227th. We put in long-range reconnaissance patrols, and we usually did that at last light. And that was always a hairy thing, because you drop off these five-man teams in the middle of nowhere, and I mean, we'd go out places that we'd never been before. You drop these guys off, and then would circle and wait for them to make radio contact where their base was. And I'd say only half the time they'd stay in. You know, we might fly back to Elsie English, and by that time they're calling that they want out, and then you have a night rescue. And those were always big shoot-em-ups.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but we did that a lot, you know, or somebody would get hurt going in because it crazy places we dropped them off on the side of these mountains, guys breaking legs and stuff. And one time we put them in a mountain just overlooking English, and we put them right in on top of some enemy troops, right amongst them.
Wow.
I mean, I wasn't flying the slick, but the slick did it. As soon as the slick touched down and dropped them off and was pulling out, they start taking fire. They were surrounded.
Now, was that... were those NVA or NVC?
I can't really tell because I never talked to the LERPs, as long as they had guns and were shooting. But at Bonk Son, we fought a combination of both VC and NVA. I'd say we probably shot more or killed more NVA at Bonk Son than Viet Cong. But there was still a lot of Cong there.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you, as a gunship pilot, were you responsible for providing a report after action, after each action, and give an estimate of how many enemy were killed and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, but it was never written. I just go into operations and do it verbally. And the only time I ever... was actually sat down and grilled about something was once the ship I was in, or the fire team I was in, was accused of firing on some friendlies, and it wasn't us, and we were grilled a lot about that. And the other time was other times were about actions, were awards that were going to be given. And they wanted to make sure everybody's stories jived, and you know, and they had somebody taking down dictation. But most of the time, you just went in and said, I was here, point on the map, gave the grid coordinates, took fire, killed three enemy, saw two weapons. Sometimes you'd pick the weapons up if you thought it was safe. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you didn't. Most of the time, you didn't. At the time we thought we shot or we were accused of shooting on some friendlies, is we were following a flight back toward English, but we were way out away from it. And I think it was some gunships from the 227th fired on some. As we moved by this spot where these other gunships had fired on some LERPs, they were cutting an LZ. They'd get pulled out. And obviously, they weren't in any trouble if they were, you know, cutting trees. And I remember seeing them as we went over to them. In fact, they waved. And we moved up maybe another 2 or 3 miles, and we caught some NVA on a ridgeline in tall grass. And they were just hunkered down in this elephant grass, but we happened to be the only ship that flew right over them. The six slicks were off to our left or right. I can't remember. And the other gunship was, I think, off to the right. Well, so the slicks would be off to our right also. And we just happened to go over the spot, and they just were hunkered down there in the grass. And we went over them maybe by 200 feet. We could see that they were, you know, they were by their uniforms that they were definitely bad guys. You know, pith helmets and AKs and stuff. commander. And he just said, "Let's just keep on, just keep going like we didn't see him." And we went up about another half a mile, and then we turned around, and then we just made a run on them. And the ones we didn't kill on the first pass jumped right off the side of this cliff. It wasn't a cliff, the mountain was just real steep. And a couple fell to their death, and a couple got some branches and hung on as they before they fell all the way down the mountain. As they were hanging there, we came around and we killed them. And we guess we killed about 15 guys. But we got blamed for shooting at the LERP team. And the LERP team, finally, when they got in, we got grilled real good. And when the LERP team finally was picked up and brought back, they said that the gunships that killed the guys over on, they said so they could see that hill a couple miles away. We're engaging something over there. We're not the same aircraft that shot at us. So, and it was just one door gunner that shot. And he was able. He didn't hit any of them. So, but that was one of the times that I really had to give a big report. But most of the time, it was pretty nonchalant.
Okay. Now, for the first, let's see, you got there in April. So the first 8 months that you were there, from April until December of 67, would you say that the tempo of operations increased, decreased, or stayed the same?
I'd say, I don't know what I have in the paper there, but it was, I'd say it increased.
But there was more enemy activity, more operational activity on both sides, or?
Yeah, because the enemy started, we didn't know it, but the enemy started gearing up for Tet.
Yeah.
And so there was more enemy activity, and the 2nd Platoon in Delta 229th and B Company 229th were part of a ready reaction force for the Central Highlands.
Okay.
And also the 2nd of the 12th Infantry of the 1st Air Cav, I don't know what brigade they were in, was part of that reaction force. And so wherever there was trouble, they sent us. And we were sent to Tuiwa once to help out, and we were set to Kontum Dok To area for the big battle up there all of November. And I don't know when we exactly got there, but it was either the end of October to the end of November, because I know that we were there for Thanksgiving, and we were involved in, very few people know that, but we were right in the thick of the Battle of Dok To, and I'm sure you heard of that, the Battle of Dok To of 67.
Yes, sir.
And so
what was your role there?
Chasing the bad guys and doing there was reconnaissance for the battalion commander for the 2nd of the 12th. So the gunships would go out, because we didn't have any scout aircraft with us, would go out and look for the bad guys, and supported the airstrip at Dok To. And air assaulted the 2nd of the 12th, wherever they wanted to be. Worked with the 4th Infantry Division and the 173rd Airborne. I can remember there being there one day with two C-130s burning right on the apron where they unloaded on the runway, right off the runway, getting mortared while I was refueling there up there at night. Flew up there one night. We had a downed Chinook. I could get detailed, but all the ammo dump had been blowing up all day, and all the C4 went up at one time. And we were about 2 miles off of the. It was just myself and another gunship off the perimeter at Dok To, and it looked like a nuclear explosion. The fireball went about 800 feet, and then we read later in the Stars and Stripes that. Up until that point, that was the largest explosion that ever had gone off in Vietnam. But I mean, I could feel the shock when it hit the aircraft. You know, you could feel the aircraft jump from that. And they use those. I don't know if they weighed 10,000 pounds or 15,000 pounds. I don't know what they weighed. That they were called those commando vaults. They were instant LZ.
They, daisy cutters.
Yeah, something like that. They made a. You know, when they went off, you could like put 24 ships or 12 ships or something in there after that. And we used those up there, and I never saw trees any bigger in my life than I did up around Doctow and Quantum. And we worked from the border all the way, you know, to Doctow, and I think Doc Peck Special Forces Camp. It was really. But I think when we left there, out of the four gunships that we took up, only three were flyable. When we were finally sent back to Onkay to stand down for maintenance, and we had to, the three of them had to be slung back, and one flew, so the other pilots, crews grabbed rides on the slicks, because they brought the infantry up on C-130s.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose many personnel?
My Delta 229 did not, very fortunate, had a lot of aircraft battle damage, but we didn't lose anybody, but the Bravo 229, the slick company did. I don't remember how many, but I remember them losing quite a few people.
This will end interview number one with Al DeMilo.